Welcome, everyone. You are in debunking the detested decoction. I am Martin Brungard, one of your AHA governing committee members, and I appreciate every one of you being here today and in this session this hour. Help me welcome our speaker. This is John Van Itley. He is with the James River Homebrewers, and he is an active member and an officer of their club, as well as a national BJCP judge, so he certainly has some credentials. In addition, through his 18 years of brewing, he has become a graduate of the Siebel Institute, and I have to admit that that's a big goal of mine. Not that I'll ever be a pro, but it would be cool to do. And he says when he's not brewing beer or playing engineer at his day job, he's found tweaking and building new brewing equipment and systems. So he certainly is a tweaker and a tinkerer. He is from Richmond, Virginia. And just as a side note, please set your phones to stun so that we don't have to call you out as that guy. And with that, debunking the detested decoction. Okay, I had a sake this morning. I'm sorry. Welcome, James.
All right, good morning, everybody. I like to see a lot of these malting people here, mashing in Michigan. I thought it was very appropriate to do a topic on decoction brewing. With that in mind, you never need to do a decoction. So what am I doing here? I'm just kidding. We'll come back to this. I just wanted to say for now, you know, this is true. You never do need to do one. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't. I must have heard this statement, you know, 100 times at last year's convention, and that really got me thinking, you know. You know, why not? Why, you know, what's so big? What's such a big deal about it? Why is it such a detested thing to do? Before I get too deep, though, important things always come first. There are two beers that are going to be passed around. The first is the Time Devastator Doppelbock. This was done with a traditional triple decoction. And you know, my personal opinion is I put too much Carafa in it, but. You can see pretty much how it went there. And the second beer is a Skunky Monkey Hefeweizen. This was done, if any of you read the old 2010 Zymergy on bringing out intense banana aromas using a pseudo-decoction type method. This was what was done with this one. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. No real rhyme or reason, just drink, and hopefully that'll lessen the blow. All right, so what is a decoction? Hopefully most of you know more or less what this is all about. It's essentially you can provide multiple temperature steps through your mash by taking a portion of it, typically around a third. You bring that mash to a boil, and you put it back in the mash, and then you have a second step to your mash. Basically done to provide a lot of different temperature steps along the way, and we also create complex melanoidin flavors as we do it. So you can see a graph here. This is kind of a typical type of graph. This one's showing a German double decoction process and includes also some step mashing that's not done with decoctions. And you see it had like a protein rest. Actually, there's a real short acid rest in the beginning, followed by protein rest, a beta amylase step, an alpha amylase step, and a mash out, two decoctions along the way. The red spikes represent where you would pull out a portion of that and do a decoction. The really long protein rest, that is pretty typical for a lot of these decoction processes. We'll talk a little bit about why that is. But first, you know, why would anybody ever do this? Where did this come from? Now, the general thought is, of course, that, you know, people didn't have thermometers. So how would I know, how hot my mash is? How would I know to get the right temperature? If I don't have a thermometer, And I want to have a very repeatable process of doing it over and over again. You know, they came up with this way of, you know, you just pretty much start where you start, you boil, you put it back in, and if you do the same amount and the same volumes each time, you can end up with a fairly repeatable process and get the right temperatures as you go. They didn't necessarily know what those temperatures were, but they seemed to work. And with a lot of trial and error, they eventually got the horse facing the right way and the round wheels on the cart, and it started to work. Of course, you can't ignore that who did this was mainly the Germans. And that's where a lot of these other influences come into. So we've all heard, of course, of the Rheinheitsgebot. Any of you have ever worked with or known Germans or are a German, you know, they're very regimented type of people. I used to work for a German company. And, you know, you will not add salts. You will not add adjunct. Don't even think about adding acid to your mash. So they, you know, came up, you know, with other ways of doing that, and that's where some of this comes into play. And, of course, there is also a very strong tradition that came out of the German brewing. And that's, you know, worked its way also into the Viennas, and even, you know, coming into the Pilsners, where, you know, the first Pilsner, even though it was done in Pilsen, Czech, was done by a German who moved there. And developed their process as well. And so it's very much continental Europe, maybe some of the Mexican lagers that came from the Vienna lagers that were that moved from that area. I threw this in because it's fun. This is actually a recipe that one of our club members, Dan Maurer, uncovered during an excavation of the Curls Plantation. This was in the James River, eastern Henrico County. So they found this beer recipe. And I'll read it real quick. Take 3 bushels malt, half high, half pale, dried. Let your water boil, and then put your mashing tube when the steam is gone off, so you may see your face. Then put your malt, and after mashing it well, cover it with a blanket. Let it stand 2 hours, then draw it off slow. Then boil it 3 or 4 hours till the hops curdle. When boiled enough, cool a little and work that with your yeast. So put the rest of your work in until it cools. Let it be in small tubs. Let it work till your yeast begins to curdle. And then turn it up and stop your barrel when it is done working. Note, to every bushel's malt, 1/4 pound of hops. So that is verbatim what came out of this recipe. Now, the interesting thing here, and the only thing that reason for it being in a decoction, because it has nothing to do with decoctions, is how they got their temperature. And so the let your water boil and then put your mashing tube when the steam is gone off so as you may see your face. We did this a couple times, and that comes out to 165 degrees when you can see your face, which is actually a pretty good temperature to throw your malt in and get some good starch conversion. Single infusion mash. This was, you know, 1600s that they were doing this. So clearly, decoction is not the only way to get temperature control. By the way, it's a good beer if you guys want to brew it. There's the recipe. All right, I hope you got your beers because there's a little bit of chemistry coming in. I can't help myself being an engineer. We really have to thank Louis-Camille Maillard. He was the guy who came up with the Maillard reactions. Always want to call them Maillard reactions, but that would be cooking a duck. What are Maillard reactions? So really some complex looking things up here that are supposed to represent some chemical things. What you want to know with this is there's 2 starting components. There's a reducing sugar and an amino compound. An amino compound would be like an amino acid, a protein, small type of thing like that. Reducing sugars from your malt. And then in the presence of heat, and actually not a whole lot of water, less water works better. It goes through a series of reactions that we don't need to go into all of them. And you finally end up with your melanoidin pigments and melanoidin flavors. This is unlike other things in mashing and brewing. This is a non-enzymatic reaction. So we aren't using enzymes to create melanoidins. It's strictly coming from the reaction of the acid, the amino, and the sugar, and it is, you know, temperature related. It'll up to 329 degrees Fahrenheit or 165°C, depending on what you like to use. Above that point, you essentially reach pyrolysis, caramelization. Its molecules just fall apart. Very different reaction than what we're looking at with a melanoidin type ending point. There's a lot of things that go into speeding up or slowing down your myoreaction. Your protein, more sugar, obviously will give you more melanoidins. Higher temperature until you reach a point. Less water. Longer cooking time. Some of these are obvious, some less so. The two I kind of want to call out are the pH. You know, we're always trying to get a little bit lower pH when we're doing our mashing, but in terms of generating more melanoidins, actually a higher pH will give you more of that type of reaction. And then pressure, this one's interesting because there's a little bit of conflicting research out there. Some says that, you know, a higher pressure will speed up your initial reaction products, but the overall increase of pressure seems to suppress the final products of the Meyer reaction. So there's lots of things you get from melanoidins. There's good, there's not so good. We're usually aiming for the good. Malty, bread crust, caramel, coffee, roasted, sweet, nutty, butterscotch, toffee, molasses, dark fruit, winey. I mean, these go on forever and ever. There are thousands and thousands of components that can be created through a Meyer reaction and through melanoidin formation. Some of them aren't so good. Generally, we avoid the not so good by having good sugars, good quality malts, and, you know, not burning and scorching things. I figured I'd worth throwing in a little bit of information on melanoidin malt. I didn't really know how melanoidin malt was made until I started doing this, so I contacted Wireman and they sent me a bunch of information. Essentially, what happens is they do dry the kernels, so you go through your normal steeping process, your germination, and they will send them then through a light kilning through to dry it. After they've been dried, they send them into the same type of processes for caramelization at this point, but they're no longer wet. So if you're making crystal malt or caramel malt, you're sending big, wet, plump kernels directly into high heat, and that's creating a lot of caramel flavors. But to make, and Munich's kind of the same way, Munich and melanoidin malt, we're actually sending now the dried kernels in. So it's a lot like making some of the roasted malts, only we're not going as hot to do it. And that's how they do it. And that makes a certain amount of sense because, as we said a minute ago, less water actually helps your melanoidin reaction and speeds up that process. So a little bit of a discussion on enzymes. Clearly, enzymes could be their own presentation all in itself, and I'm sure I'm going to blow my time as it is. But enzymes are proteins, and so there's a lot of different proteins that we're making in terms of our mash. Some of them are enzymes, some of them are aminos, some of them are long-chain proteins that are important for foam stability, body, and that sort of thing. Most of the time, an enzyme's name ends in the word ace. That means to cleave. So what that enzyme does is the first part of the word. So phytase would cleave phytin, create phytic acid. Protease is kind of a general term that will cut proteins into smaller proteins, amino acids. Amylase, amylose, amylopectin. And maltase, which is an interesting one, actually cuts maltose to create glucose. And again, I'm sure most of us know this, the enzyme health depends a lot on, the pH conditions, temperature. Every enzyme's got its optimal pH and its optimal temperature. And that's, really what you're doing during your step mash is you're hitting a lot of these different pieces. And I'm not going to go through all of this because that's would be a bit too much for this this presentation. But I do want to hit on acid rests a little bit because this is something that you do see in decoction brewing that you don't see many other places. And this is done for actually really two reasons. Partly is to lower your mash pH and also to help create some more of those aminos that are going to play into a melanoidin type reaction. So normally when we mix our mash and dough in, we get a pH drop, and that's done because of malt phosphate that reacts form with the calcium in the mash, and the magnesium in the mash forms calcium phosphate and releases hydrogen ions, and that's what causes our mash pH coming down to 5.2. But acid rests actually do two more things. One is the use of that malt phytase to break down the phyton and produce the phytic acid. So you're creating acid through that that's going to drop your pH. And the other is it actually will create some lactic acid from bacteria that's growing on the malt. And that's a good temperature there to start growing and producing some acidity from that lactic acid that's already on malt. If you ever want to get, you know, lactic bacteria, buying a culture seems like a silly thing to do because it's growing all over your malt. Just get some malt and culture it from that. Moving in a little bit to talking about mash thickness. So there's, a lot of people ask when you do decoctions, how thick should you be doing your decoction? And like everything, well, it depends. Starting with the main mash, this is probably the biggest strain on homebrewer to do a decoction, would be starting with a really thin mash, 2 to 3 quarts per pound. Part of the reason for that is to give you a little bit of higher pH. If you're doing an acid rest, that will compensate a little bit, bring your pH down. But then when you go in and start doing your actual decoction pulls, now we're starting to pull a little bit of a thicker mash, and sometimes one, sometimes even less than one. And this is, as I said, far from gospel, but less water produces more melanoidins. A lot of your sugar in the early parts is still built up within the grain itself. It hasn't all made it into the liquid, and so if you're getting more and more of that, the actual grain into your boiling process for your decoction, you have more sugars, more reducing sugars, more aminos present there to do it. So a thicker decoction in the beginning will produce more melanoidins. Now, if you're doing multiple decoction steps, as you move later and later through your decoction process, you want that to get a little bit thinner and thinner. So your first decoction, if you're doing triple decoction, might be in the 0.8 to 1.0 quarts per pound. Your second one, 1 to 1.5. And third, pretty thin, 2 to 3. And this is, again, because as your sugar dissolves, it's going to become now more into the water itself, less bound up in the grain. And there's also more tannin that's going to be bound up in that grain. So in the early parts, you've got an opportunity. Everybody asks about tannin, which I'll talk about here in a second, but you've got an opportunity in some of your later mash process to break down and work with that tannin that had been dissolved through the boiling process. But late in the boil, you're going to bring some more of that tannin in. So volume, if you like math, there it is. If you don't like math, there are plenty of software programs to tell you how much volume to decoct to hit exactly the temperatures you want to do. There is a thickness component. It's not just volume, but that thickness component's not very significant. And some of the software that's out there will compensate for it. All right, so one of the popular things to do when you're doing a decoction is to do a rest on the decoction itself. And so you can see on here where it's just a single decoction, and we've stopped for 10, 15 minutes at 155, 160 in that range. And essentially doing an alpha amylase rest on your decoction itself. This is useful for a few things. One, it can break down more starch in this early process. So if you haven't gotten to any kind of an amylase rest yet, you've still got big sugars. You don't have down in the reducing sugar range. So this can give you more reducing sugar to produce more melanoidin. And it can also create more thinner beer in the end. So because you're doing this before you've done your beta amylase, essentially what you've done, so alpha amylase, I told you I wouldn't do too much enzymes, but I can't help it. Alpha amylase works essentially by cutting amylopectin randomly, anywhere that there's a 1,4 bond. Whereas beta amylase works by cutting exactly two sugars each time. Two glucose chains makes a maltose chain, and it cuts those from the end each time. Now, beta amylase can't get past a 1,6 bond. So every time there is a meeting of the chains, a meeting of the sugars there where you've got a branch in your amylopectin, that's a 1,6 bond in your glucose chains, and neither alpha amylase nor beta amylase can cut that. So beta amylase, which only cuts two sugars, works at a lower temperature, and alpha amylase works at higher temperature. So what you can actually do with a decoction is you can introduce now an alpha amylase rest on your decoction, which is going to create more N's that the beta amylase can then come and cut two sugars at a time. So you can end up with a much thinner mash in the end, or a much thinner fermentation, a lower gravity, by doing this, because you've actually exposed more places for fermentable sugars to occur and less dextrins in the end. Talk a little bit about efficiency. Oh, I did want to go back up a minute. This is really good if you're doing this type of process for continental pilsners, German pils, think light-bodied type of beers. I tend to avoid this if I'm doing something like a big Doppelbock or something that I want a lot of body and a lot of big, rich malt out of. It's just not worth it to me to do that process. Most people assume that when you do a decoction, you're going to get a higher efficiency, and there's a lot of reasons why you would get a higher efficiency. More starch is exposed, you get more borderline malt converted because you're breaking down, exposing a lot more stuff. You're going through a lot more enzyme steps, so there's more stuff that can happen. It's a much longer process, so you have more opportunity there as well. But what actually often happens is because you've started with such a thin mash, your sparge isn't as effective. You have a lot less time to do the sparging that you do. And so it's really not uncommon to get a lower efficiency when you do this, because your sparging is just can't, you know, you've already diluted so much and you just can't take the amount of time to rinse that off unless you're going to boil for 6 hours. And if you've already mashed for 6 hours, you probably don't want to boil for that long too. Tannin extraction. So I touched on this briefly. A lot of people say, why are decocted beers, why don't they taste, you know, really astringent and have a lot of tannins to it? And there was a presentation many years ago that I found reference to, I wasn't at it, that was presented at this conference, where a German actually said, hey, you know, there really is some tannin, you know, you really do get tannin, it's a lot more pleasant than you expect it to be. And I think that's true. I think that not only are we tasting malonoidins when we're tasting some of the complexity in a decocted beer, but we're also tasting some tannins that have been broken down a little bit differently than we expect them to. So there's a couple schools of thought as to why this is. One is that just by having a large amount of sugar that when you're boiling it with, that helps buffer the polyphenol production during the decoction. And the second school of thought is that you have enzymatic processes in the mash, once you've reintroduced that, that helps to break down some of those tannin components that you've now dissolved. I'm not really the expert on either of those, so all I know is if I'm decocting to mash out, I'm only going to pull liquid. I'm not going to pull any grain if I can help it, if I'm doing that, because at that point, you've got a lot less chance to break it down in later points. So, remember, and I said when the mash thickness, the early ones you want, you know, really thick, the later ones you want really thin. If you actually decocked all the way up to a mash out temperature, yeah, you want no grain at all at that point. All right, so all this sounds like a lot of work. I have a theory called the personal flavor labor enhancement value, or the PFLEV. This essentially says, you know, the more effort you put into the beer, the better it tastes, at least to you. Talk a little bit about equipment. I'll come back to other reasons other than PFLEV, but some equipment. One of the really nice things about decoction mashing is if you can do all grain mashing, I mean, not brew in a bag necessarily, but traditional all-grain brewing, you can do decocting. If you've got one of these picnic mash tuns that I used for many, many years, you can essentially do a decoction with that and, not worry about putting it on an open flame and wondering what that's going to do to your plastic-bottomed cooler. Other equipment you need is pretty minimal. So a measuring device, saucepan works really well. Just know how big your saucepan is and count that out. A decoction pot. Probably have a pot already. You probably have a brew pot if all else fails. a burner of some sort, or heating source. If you're heating a boil, you probably have one of those already. And, you know, you might want a thermometer, but, you know, these things were done before thermometers existed. So I actually thought it was fun one day to actually brew a decoction beer and tape over my thermometer. I have no idea what temperatures I hit, but it was pretty good beer. So again, using a brew pot and a burner, if you don't have another pot that you can use for decoction and you want to use your brew pot, that's good. It may be a little bit harder to transfer it back into your main mash when you're done. It's maybe a little bit bigger than you need it to be. Better to go too big than too small. I have spent many a time doing a decoction on a small or too small of a pot thinking, man, this is just hard to manage. Using a brew pot actually works pretty well for this. The only thing is, you know, make sure you clean it before you go and do your final boil, because you will have some residual husk material that can lead to some astringency. Some other things about, you know, talked a little bit about this already. You can do some interesting experiments when it comes to decoction brewing. You can do an alpha amylase before beta amylase. And the Hefeweizen, which it looks like is going around now, used this beta amylase decoction followed by a maltase, which is what created a glucose, which is a pretty neat type of process. So tips for making your decoction better. Tip one, these are going to be pretty generic. Have a plan. Don't just go into it thinking you're going to do it. Just know how you want to do it. Where are you going to heat things? Where are you going to measure? How am I going to measure my volumes? How am I going to not make a mess? I've made many messes over the years. How do I calculate my volume? And if you really are a numbers guy, do you have your calculator with you so that if you miss your steps, because you will, they won't be perfect, you might want to adjust and change for that. You may want to start pulling more volume or less volume on later decoction steps. Can I do other things in parallel? Like drink a beer. Things take longer than planned. It is really easy to make these graphs and show that, you know, yeah, it's going to take 10 minutes to get to a boil. 30 minutes later, why has this thing not started boiling yet? So give yourself a little bit of an extra time. Don't rush it. Take your time. And don't scorch it because you're not getting your temperature fast enough. Don't just turn your heat up and try to combat that fact that things take longer, because we really don't want to kill this. You want to take your time, nice slow ramp, stir really well as it's going, drink a beer. Just, you know, let it get to where it gets to. If your mash steps take a little bit longer as a result, hopefully you've allowed that much time in your brew day. Watch splashing. Hot side aeration, some people believe in it, some people don't. This is a good opportunity to introduce hot side aeration if you're not careful. Dumping things back and forth, pulling a big pot over and splashing it around. Just go gentle as you can with it. If you have a way of transferring the grain and the liquid together without blowing it, try to do what you can with it. But particularly in more subtle lager beers, it's something to watch out for. What other implications? You know, the Doppelbock there, this one really surprised me. I mean, it had a real thin mash, not really what you would consider a heavy protein type beer. That thing clogged the hell out of my rim system when I was doing this, because there was just so much protein that was generated. So it's not a bad idea to throw some rice hulls in, especially if you are, like me and have developed a rim system in addition to doing decoctions. You know, it wasn't easy enough once I developed this thing to measure my temperature, so I figured I had to start doing decoctions, right? Keep in mind that, what impact is it going to have on efficiency? You know, it might be lower. A lot of people think it's going to be higher, but your efficiency might be lower, so keep that in mind as you're doing it. Make sure you have the right volumes. I mean, it's very easy to screw up your volume and not have enough in your mash or your pot or your mash tun or your boil pot. And how much sparge water do you need? If you've got a really thin decoction, you might need a little bit less sparge water going on. And, you know, it's certainly not my original advice, but relax. Don't worry. Have a home brew. In fact, every decoction step's just a great opportunity to do that. By the way, along those notes, I wouldn't mind having some of the beer come make its way up here, too. All right, so you never need to do a decoction. I told you I'd come back to this. Essentially, you know, this is true. With the modern malts that we have available to us, you don't need to do this. There are tons of adjuncts that can give similar, if not the same, and undetectable changes to what you're going to do. And no kidding, this really is a lot of time and effort to do this process. But, you know, this is kind of a silly argument to me because I love to make beer, you know. And it's kind of like I say to the guy that's on the that loves to play golf, why do you want to do 18 holes? Wouldn't 9 holes of golf be enough for you? You know, if you're really going to spend the day making a making beer and having fun with it, if you're dreading it and you're not, you know, you don't want to spend the time to do this, you might want to like relook at why you like making beer. It's a fun thing to do, and you know, make the brew day longer. That's fine by me. That's more time I get to spend doing what I like to do. So, yeah, you can use specialty malts. You know, the big thing here, though, we talked a little bit about how that melanoidin malt's made. It doesn't really go through the same process as what a decoction does. You've got different water. You don't have things ground up. Thank you very much. It's just not the same process. So, yes, you can get some of the same malt. Malts today are really amazing. But are they the same as what you're going to get with a decoction? I don't think they quite are. But it's up to you as the brewer to decide. So why do we brew? Personally, you know, I like to brew for the personal flavor, labor enhancement value. This beer probably tastes a lot better to me than to you. The process of brewing, you know, to me, that's the whole fun. I love the process. It's all about the process. It's all about having fun doing it. But there's also a little bit of history, a little bit of tradition, and just a love of the craft. And so, to me, decoction's pretty much the same way, just taken a little bit more to the extreme. You put more labor into it, so it's going to taste even better, right? At least to you. The process here, I mean, it's just more process, more history, and more things you can do that you couldn't do. I mean, you can experiment with all kinds of things with this in terms of playing with different higher, lower temperatures along the way. Most breweries really don't decoct, and this is one of those interesting things. A brewery has to go and make major investments in order to have the equipment to do it. Plus, you know, they're trying to make a product, right? So unlike home brewers, it's harder for them to do it. For us, if you can mash, you can decoct. It's just, you know, put it on the burner. It is nice to see some, so, you know, call out Devil's Backbone. How many of you went to the Long Live Lagers presentation yesterday? So I know Jason said someone else said this, but this is now Jason Oliver's quote. Decoction brewing is like a dog licking its balls. If you can do it, maybe you should try. I thought that was really great. You know, so a lot of the people that are out there that are saying there's no reason to decoct, you shouldn't do it, there's no reason. I mean, these are people that can't do it or don't want to do it. Why listen to them? Why not just try it and see for yourself? There's some other breweries that threw out, Aldebert's Brewery out there, they're also doing, in fact, most of the beers that they do are decocted, and I think that's just great to see some breweries that are out there doing them. And, you know, there are many more. There's no way I could list them all. So what should I decoct? Who did that triple decoction Imperial IPA? Generally, you want to do something malty. Traditionally, it's, you know, the European lagers, continental pilsners. I think a Bow Pils is just a great decoction beer. This wheat beer, I think this comes out really well with decoction. It's just something you can't do the same other ways. Big beers generally decoct well. Some of your hybrids, your alt beers, your Kolsch are worth experimenting with. Things I wouldn't do. Pretty much anything hoppy, I'm not going to go and bother to decoct with that. It's just not, Pilsner may be the exception to that, but If you're really looking for caramel flavors, you know, your English ales, some of your brown ales, things that really want more of that caramel, that's not really a decoction process to get that, so you're going to go a different way with it. Steam beer, not really worth. Strong roasted malts, I don't really think you're going to see much of a difference doing a decoction with that if roast and chocolate are kind of your more dominant flavors. And there's plenty worth experimenting with, though, and I'm not going to tell you don't do something because, you know, hey, you're the brewer. You know, part of the fun of home brewing, craft brewing, is just experimenting, trying new things, learning about new ways to make things happen. I like graphs. So there's a number of these I'm going to go through so that I have some time for you guys to ask questions. I'm going to go through them fairly quickly. This would be a traditional triple decoction without any rests along the way. This is essentially what the Doppelbock y'all were drinking was made with. So started with an acid rest, a protein rest. The interesting thing here is there's one sacrification rest, so it kind of split the difference between the beta and the alpha, and then a mash out. This has also become really popular where you kind of make things a little bit shorter, don't take quite as long to do it, and instead of having a protein rest and an acid rest, you pick one or the other, and then you have two sacrification rests, so a beta amylase and an alpha amylase rest along the way. This is probably the easiest one to start with if you want to just try decoction. Just start with a beta amylase rest, decoct, throw it out, you know, end up at an alpha amylase, and mash out, and you're done. You know, the rest of those were, you know, those were 5-hour mashes. This one's only about a two and a half hour mash at this point. So, you know, it's a little bit less of a, you know, imposing type of thing to be starting off with and a little bit easier. If you want to take it just a little bit in the next step, throw a rest in there. So this is what I do this with my German pills and my Bow pills. Just a single decoction. You start with a protein. You move up to an alpha rest on your decoction. Then you do your decoction boil and you bring it back down to a beta. I think this is a great schedule for doing continental pilsners and you know, some of the thinner bodied beers. Again, this one's only about a 3-hour, so it's not as bad as some of the others. And that includes the mash out, you know. All right, if you really want to, you know, try something complicated, drink if you like graphs. This basically, you start with an acid rest. And this is really actually kind of cool, because what you do is you stop along the way on your first decoction with a protein rest, a low-temp protein rest. That's going to give you more of your aminos. And then you jump up to an amylase rest. That's going to give you your reducing sugars. And so by the time you're actually doing that boil on your decoction, you've got your starting components for the Meyer reaction going on. Then you throw some, but not all of it, back in to do a real short protein rest on your main mash. This is at a little bit of higher temperature protein. So you're, at this point, you're just trying to get your little bit of break and reducing of the proteins for head and that type of thing. And then you dump the rest of it back in that you've been boiling all along. You're at your sacrification, and then finally do your mash out. I think it's a pretty cool process. I've actually never tried this one, but I think it would be cool to try. I think there's really some really neat things with that. All right, this is the one that's the Hefeweizen that's going around. So I did want to take just a couple minutes to describe what this is. So this was pretty much stolen from that Zymergy 2010, I think it was like April. You can find it online. This was all along when I used to make Hefeweizens, I used to just struggle to get the banana and the clove out of it. And, you know, there's all these things about what temperature should you do, how much yeast should you pitch, so on and so forth in order to do it. Well, according to this article, that's all well and good, but the real way to do it is to load up your fermentables with a large amount of glucose versus maltose, and that stresses the yeast in the right way to get your banana and your clove. So what you essentially do is you start at a really low temp, and they call it an enzyme rest at this point. You're generating maltase. maltase breaks maltose down into glucose. You then, while you're doing that, pull a decoction. You don't boil it. You just do a beta amylase rest on that. So you're creating a lot of maltose in that decoction step. Throw that back in, and then that comes in at the temperature for maltase. So now that maltose that you've created in your beta amylase decoction step can get broken down into glucose. And then when you jump up your step, you skip the beta. I mean, you really skip the beta. You go all the way up into the 162 range and do an alpha amylase rest just to give it some body and sweetness, and then mash out. Again, this actually isn't too bad. This is about 3 hours, 3.5 hours to do this. I've done it 3 or 4 times now, and it's amazing. I mean, I don't know about you guys. Is there a lot of banana and clove in this thing? Yeah. And the temperature I fermented this at was like 67 degrees. So, you know, I did not stress this yeast at all with it, and it just was really amazing how much it was able to do. I always have to throw this one in. Oops, I missed my temperature step decoction. So you got a picnic cooler, something went wrong, you're at 130 degrees. Do a decoction, bring it up to where you want it to be. Pseudo decoction. This one was sent to me by Jeff. You out there? Yeah. This was also a Zymergy article. This is if you want to try it without a really... You start with two mashes. One mash, you do a real quick alpha amylase rest, raise that up to boil, and then you put that back into the other one that you were doing at a beta. So you can do this in really 2 hours or less and still get some of the benefits of a decoction without going through the whole process. Jeff also suggested doing the pressure cooker. I'm not sure how much I agree with him on that one, because the research I've seen does say that the pressure cooker will actually reduce the amount of melanoidin you create. But, you know, I think it's something worth experimenting. You know, I can only take so much research at face value. At the end of the day, it's how does the beer taste and how does it work. So it's worth trying. And, you know, invent your own. Do a quad decoction. Hey, why not, right? So to wrap up, you never need to do a decoction. Absolutely true. But just like any other brewing process, you know, this can be a real valuable tool. It might not be as bad as you think it is. And, you know, you learn a lot. Some of what you learn will help with the non-decocted beer, too. So just throw out a special thanks to Devil's Backbone, especially Jason Oliver for letting me steal his quote, and Wireman. And any questions?
And since we are recording this, please come up to the microphone. Please queue up here with your questions.
The standard wisdom has been with modern malts, they've already taken care of breaking down the proteins, and it's dangerous to rest at protein rests for any length of time because then you'll end up with a thin-bodied beer with no head retention. Could you address that? No, I mean by theory, not by...
I mean, that's true. With most of those, that's true. But you really don't you don't need to, and you can definitely get good-bodied beer and good head retention. And if you start breaking down too much the proteins, then you will have head retention problems. When you're doing some of those protein rests, though, it all depends on the temperature that you do it at. And so if you're hitting too long at a higher... protein rest, that's going to hit some of your head retention. Some of the lower temperatures, so there's a lot of enzymes in there. Some of those enzymes create aminos. Some of them create some of the more proteins that are responsible for body. And eventually you're cutting out, you know, protein so much to the point that you don't have any for head retention. My experience has been I still get pretty good head retention with a protein rest, and by doing it at the lower temperature protein where I'm trying to optimize for the amino production, that's giving me those components that I need to actually bring out the melanoidins more. And so, you know, this one was the triple decoction, had the acid, had a protein, and, I mean, it's got a head on it. It's still there, so it's not going over, but I would say that, you know, don't worry too much.
Well, one of the objectives here is the melanoidin production, and
let's compare and contrast the effect of decoction, and then there's all, I just did a Scottish, so I did a reduction. And don't we get, at least in terms of melanoidin, don't we get something similar with those processes?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what a reduction is, so maybe... Oh, okay. Sure. So boil, you know, concentrated boiling during it. Really, at that point, you're going to get more caramelization than you're going to get melanoidin formation. Why is that? I'm not sure entirely. Partly, probably the lower amounts of protein that you're going to have to generate it. But my experience has been, once you get it into the boil, at that point, you're doing kettle caramelization. You're not really getting the melanoidin formation the same way.
Any other questions?
We do.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for coming out. I apologize. I was sitting in the back. So it looked like you were holding your boils on your decoction for 10 to 20 minutes. I don't know if that was right. Is there a minimum maximum time that you would recommend?
It's really kind of up to you on that one. I would say less than 10 minutes. You've spent a lot of time and effort to get it up there, and you might not be getting much out of it. Anything less than 10 minutes would be almost, unless you're only purely going for a temperature change and not trying to get anything else out of it. 30 minutes is probably, on average, what you see in most of the traditional schedules. Do what you like.
So how crucial is the grain portion of doing the decoction? If we did a thin mash with a rims and then stepped up but didn't have the boiling of the grain, do we get something pretty similar to a decoction, or is it pretty necessary to have that grain in there to get the flavors?
So with are you talking about like a direct fire rims or?
Either way.
Okay. You're going to get some amount of that. I think mostly what you're going to get as you're heating that grain and heating that mash directly in the step mash, you're getting some real direct, right where you have the temperature gradient between your heating element and your main mash. You're going to get some of that temperature type that's higher than what you're eventually aiming for. So you're going to get some. I don't think you're going to get as much as if you actually pull it all out, throw it in a boil, and get it up to a boil, maintain a boil. The real temperatures for these things, we're kind of pushing the lower boundary on getting melanoidin. You'll get melanoidin at room temp, but the hotter you get, the more, and sorry, I'm going to speak Celsius, 165°C, so 65 degrees centigrade above boiling is kind of the maximum. And then above that, it turns into paralysis and caramelization. If you think about the temperature of your flame, that's like, measured more in the thousands of degrees. A heating element for electric, kind of similar. You've got much higher temperature on that than your actual boil is. So as things are passing over that, they're getting really high levels of flame. But those high levels are going, that's more likely to cause more of a caramelization effect. Getting it up and maintaining an overall body of volume that at a boiling temperature is going to maintain more of the melanoidin and the Meyer reaction.
Doing a decoction just for a mash out would add anything, since there's no grain involved in the, or very little grain involved in the liquid?
I would not think that it would add. I would, if anything, think it would be a risk for astringency at that point. Most of the ones I do, I actually don't even do a decoction for mash out. I'll do a step up to that point, or just let it be, like a single infusion guy, and let it be, and to start my sparge. There's not a whole lot you're going to get out of it, and I think you're going to run more of a risk of polyphenol pickup than anything else.
Hurry up, Tim.
Were you drinking last night?
I've been doing decoctions for 15 or 20 years and find that unless you do that dextrification rest with your decoction to break down the amylopectins, it's so thick that I always pull a very, very thick first and second decoction. It's almost impossible to get it up to boil without a chance of scorching. So I think that the dextrification rest is almost essential.
I had problems when I first was doing it, and actually, I talked about using the boil pot. That's how I've been doing it lately, and because it's such a bigger pot, it spreads out that flame a lot more even, and I've actually not had the scorching problems that I used to have when I had a smaller pot and a more concentrated burner. It's using like a banjo burner or something like that that's going to spread the heat more. It's definitely more ideal than the old jet ones that, you know, looked like you were about to light your ceiling on fire. Definitely you want to avoid scorching, and that's probably, I'm not going to dispute your advice with that by any means. I've had good results without scorching just by being careful, but.
Well, let me put a plug in then for a pressure cooker. I have a 22-quart pressure cooker. I put a 3-gallon pot inside of that because you don't want to direct fire the grains in the pressure cooker. But you don't have to stir. You don't have to worry about scorching. It's never hit by any temperature higher than the 250-degree pressurized steam. They're not cheap, these big ones, but you can find them used, which is what I did. So, and I get lots. You compare the color of the grain coming out to the one that wasn't pressure cooked. And pressure cooking is, by the way, historic. It's been done historically. 100 and some years ago in the U.S., cereal mashes were pressure cooked at some breweries and still are in some bourbon distilleries.
I won't dispute you.
And on behalf of AHA, I offer you this wonderful speaker's gift. Thank you all for attending today. We'll see you the rest of the day. Enjoy.